Okay, we're beginning here by the two dots on the top of Lamed Amud Aleph. Gemara says, Ad heichan chayav adam lelamed et bno Torah. What is the extent to which a person is obligated to teach his son Torah? One of the things enumerated in our Mishnah that a father is obligated towards his son is to teach him Torah. What is the extent of that? Am Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, kagon zvulun ben dan, shlimdo avi aviv mikra. Just like this individual, somebody from their time, whose grandfather taught him Mikra. In the normal sense, Mikra would be Tanakh. We're going to see that it's narrowed over here. Umishnah, Mishnayot. Talmud, which is similar to our Gemara, but a way to deal with the Mishnayot, to reconcile the Mishnayot, to understand them properly. Halachot, Va'agadot, Olalach V'nagadato. So here is a grandfather who is teaching his grandson. So they're asking, how far is this obligation? The obligation doesn't just sit with the father towards the son, but the obligation also sits with the grandfather towards the grandchild. Meitavei limdo mikra em lamdo mishnah. If he teaches him mikra, he doesn't have to teach him mishnah. V'amarava mikra zo Torah. Mikra is not all of Tanakh, but rather just Torah. So here you see a narrowing of that obligation of the grandparent towards the grandson to simply be about Torah itself. Chamisha chumshei Torah. But the problem is that the Gemara just brought the example of this paradigm of Zvulun ben Dan, where his grandfather taught him a large amount of material, way in excess of just Chamisha chumshei Torah. Where it says, Kizvulun ben Dan, velo kizvulun ben Dan. Like that situation, but not exactly. Kizvulun ben Dan, shindo avi aviv. Like Zvulun ben Dan, that just shows you that the obligation doesn't end at the father, but it includes the grandfather as well. So that's all they were trying to bring from that example. Falokas vulun ben dan, deilu hotam mikra mishnah v'talmud halachot v'agadot. But it's not exactly like zvulun ben dan, because over there he taught him a vast amount of material. Deilu hocha mikra livad. But over here, the obligation is only to teach him chamisha chumshei Torah. V'avi aviv mimichayiv. Since when is the grandfather obligated? V'atanya. Don't we have a braita? V'dimaretem otam et b'neichem, v'lo b'nei b'neichem. The obligation is to teach your children. And if you say children, children to the exclusion of b'nei b'neichem, your grandchildren. Uma ani mikayim. But then we have a problem because the pasuk in Devarim says, v'odatem levanecha ulu b'nei vanecha, that you have to convey, make known to your children and your grandchildren. V'omar lecha, to teach you shekol malameid et b'no Torah. So we're going to take that not a literal face value, but rather as a drasha or as an implications of teaching your son Torah, which is person who teaches the son Torah, male alav akatuv, ekilu limdo lo, believe no, ulu ben beno. We make it look as if he taught him, his child, and his grandchild, ad sof kol adorot, until the end of generations. Meaning that here, the Gemara sees, v'odatam levenecha v'levenecha, being the chain of the Misora. And so what it means that you have to inform your children and your grandchildren, here the Gemara is understanding that is a direct obligation to teach your grandchildren, but rather by passing the Misora from yourself to your children, you ensure that that Misora passes from your children to your grandchildren or their children. And so the credit for the Misora is given to you because you passed it to your children and you did your part in the chain. So ensuring that the chain is alive and well is just an obligation for you to teach your children. The result of that is a chain that extends beyond your children. So, Huda Marki Hai Tana. We have another Tana who argues on that premise. The Tanya, Vili Maritem Otam Et B'neichem. Eini Ela B'neichem. That's only your children. B'nei B'neichem Einayin. How do I know you have to also teach your grandchildren? Tamal Omar, V'odatam Levanechav Livnei B'necha. So here they take the Pasuk, literally, that V'odatam Levanechav Livnei B'necha, you have to teach your grandchildren. In came Matamal Omar B'neichem. B'neichem V'lo Menotechem. So what do they do with the word b'neichem? It goes to the drasha b'neichem lo b'noteichem, which we just saw on Daf Chavtet, which was the source for the fact that there's no obligation on the father to teach his daughters Torah, only to teach his sons Torah. And therefore, if you use that miut of b'neichem lo b'noteichem, then the miut is no longer available to say b'neichem v'lo b'nei b'neichem. And the truth is that there is an obligation then to teach the grandchildren from the pasuk of Odata Levanecha, Vilivne Vanecha, that you have to teach or make known to your children and your grandchildren the Torah. The way that the Rosh actually quotes this is, Ukashem Shechayav Lelamed Et Bino Torah, It's an actual obligation on the grandfather that might have implications with regards to certain halachot that relate between a child and a parent, or a parent and a child. Might also be true in the cases of a grandfather. I'll just make note of it. It's a much bigger and longer sugya. But in the Tshuvot HaRamah, the Ramah discusses whether a grandchild can say Kaddish for a grandparent, and whether he becomes a chiyuv, an obligatory party there, and that he can, in their day, take the amud as a mechuyav b'kaddish for the grandparent. And one of the pieces of evidence in a case here where a parent passed away is the fact that the grandparent is obligated to teach that grandchild Torah. And so there is a certain amount of relationship or obligatory relationship that might allow the grandchild in saying Kaddish to take precedence or be on equal footing with other people who are saying Kaddish for a parent. In addition, many of the Mefarshim note that this din is only true by Bnei Bonim. It's only true with your son's male children. That's where the obligation is. But grandchildren that come through your daughter, there, those grandsons may not have this obligation over here, because it says, to your son and your son's sons. There are others who read that less literally and say that even a grandson through your daughter, the same obligation applies from the grandparent to that grandchild. Now that pasuk in Perek Daled in Dvarim is a machloket, how to understand that pasuk between Rashi and the Ramban al the Torah. Pesukim le'ar, Zraki Shem Lecha, Shmor Naf Shechom Ol, Pentishkach, Et Dvarim Asher Ra'u Einecha, Upein Yesru Milbavecha Kol Yimei Chayecha, Vodatam Levanecha V'livnei V'amecha. So that's the pasuk that we're quoting. The next pasuk begins, Yom Asher Amata Lifnei Hashem Lokecha B'choreiv. So here in the pasuk you have two topics that are being addressed, and that leads to this machlok between Rashi and the Ramban as to what is the pirush in the pasukim here. Rashi learns the requirement or the mitzvah over here is a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. These pasukim are speaking about the Mesorah with regards to the Torah itself. And therefore the requirement here of Odatam Levanecha of Livnei Banecha is about the Torah itself. And contextually from the Gemara over here, it would seem that that is the case, that the Gemara sees this as an obligation of a grandfather to teach the grandchild Torah. And therefore Rashi interprets these psukim and the obligation that is bound in these psukim to be referring to Talmud Torah and the teaching of Torah. The Ramban, on the other hand, says the topic of the psukim and the context of the psukim is Yom Asher Amata Lifnei Hashem Elokecha B'choreiv, is Ma'amad Har Sinai. And therefore the obligation of transmission here is not about the content of the Torah, but rather about the event of Har Sinai, the experiential aspect of Har Sinai, somewhat of what we try to recreate in the Seder, the idea of a transmission that's not only about knowledge and content, but an experiential Mesorah, about what happened to us and what was the experience at Har Sinai, and the transmission of that Mesorah that we stood before God at Har Sinai. And so the Ramban interprets this, V'odatam l'banecha v'livnei banecha, differently. And therefore, he might also, in viewing the obligation over here, that the obligation on the grandfather might be slightly different than the obligation on the father. The father has the obligation both in terms of content as well as the experiential side. It might be that the grandfather has a greater obligation with regards to the experiential side, and that Mesorah, rather than the pure knowledge or content part of the Mesorah, the way that the Ramban reads it, because those are the psukim that are brought here by the Gemara to show the obligation of the grandfather. But taken in context, in Dvarim Dalet, the way the Ramban explains them there, the context is that of Mamad Har Sinai. And maybe that is what the Gemara is referencing over here, a much more limited in terms of quantity, but qualitatively an experiential type of Mesorah, which is also important, which is something maybe sometimes only the grandfather can give to a grandson. So I'm Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Kol melameid ben beno Torah. Anybody teaches his grandchild Torah. Vale alav ketuv kilu kibla mihar Sinai. This somewhat reinforces that idea that a grandfather that teaches a grandchild Torah, it's as if he stood, or as if he received it at Har Sinai. Shneemar v'odatam levanecha v'livnei venecha. In the next pasuk is Yom Asher Amadta Lifnei Hashem Elokecha B'choreiv. So here the Gemara sees or acknowledges this connection or juxtaposition of Amad Har Sinai to the requirement of a grandfather to teach the grandchild. which would be slightly more supportive of that view of the Ramban, even though the Gemara terms it as Melameid Ed Ben Beno Torah, tells of teaching Torah. And the idea being here that the concept of Mesorah is anybody who is a generation before is one generation closer to the Mesorah and to the experience at Har Sinai. And therefore, the passing of the torch from the grandfather to the grandchild is a stronger Mesorah than the father to the child, only because the grandfather's one step closer to the actual event and to that Mesorah. And again, like the Ramban says, if it's part of this experiential Mesorah, then it's very important that the grandfather do that, because that it has a certain impact and effect on the child that the grandfather is giving it over. It's not just the parent, and it's not just an educational aspect. There's an experiential and linkage aspect of this teaching. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Ashkechei the Rabbi Shub ben Levi, the Shadei Disna Areshe. So Rabbi Chiya bar Abba finds Rabbi Shub ben Levi, who is a Talmud Chacham, has to go out dressed appropriately. And here he like threw on a towel, basically, and ran out. Rashi says that Disna is a sheet. So instead of wearing his normal turban, his normal head covering, he just threw a sheet on his head and ran out. And he was taking his young grandson to the shul, to the Beit Midrash. So Vacha Bar Yaakov says to, Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba says to Rabbi Shub ben Levi, what are you dressed like this? What's going on? So Mizutar Mai Dichtiv. Right, you're taking lightly what it says in the Torah. It's very important. I had to run out. Now, whether he forgot he was running late, or it was something else had come up and he was delayed, but he felt compelled to take his grandchild on time to the Beit Midrash to learn Torah. And he says that it's very important that the grandfather be involved in this educational experience of the grandchild and ensure that the grandchild gets to cheder, gets to his learning. And therefore, he says he took this very, so seriously that he's willing to go out half-dressed, in a sense, to take his grandchild to school in order that he didn't miss those lessons. He didn't miss it. And he quotes the psukim that we're speaking about. How can you take lightly this obligation of odatam levanecha, levanecha, and the subsequent pasuk is yom esher matah shem lefnei shem kech b'chorev, that this imbues in the child this idea of Mamad Har Sinai when he goes to learn Torah, especially with his grandfather. So again here, this seems much more experiential. It's the grandfather who's taking the grandchild to school, to cheder. It doesn't say that he's teaching him Torah. It says that he's carrying, taking him, walking with him to school. And that experiential aspect, that Mesorah, is what Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi deems as being important, or the grandfather's role over here. Mikan ve'elech, from there forward, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, lo time umtza ad mikre the yonoka umosfe. He would not taste in the morning. Umtza is usually meat that was roasted on the fire, was some sort of breakfast treat that he had, but he wouldn't even put that in his mouth, sausage or meat that they had in the morning. Ad mikre the yonoka, until he reviewed what he had learned the day before, umosfe, and added on something new. So first of all, he took heed to what Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi had instructed. From there forward, he made sure to teach the children and put that as a priority in the morning. Like Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi ran out half-dressed to make sure that they got to school on time. So too, he didn't even eat breakfast until he made sure that they reviewed their chumash and they went ahead a little bit. It's interesting. First of all, the review is important. To go over what they learned the day before and not just assume that whatever they learned, they learned. But you have to review it. Number two is that you have to add on. Now, you could say they had to add on because that's the real limud, and therefore, in order to have real limud, you have to add something that day. I think that there's also an aspect of excitement, that if you just do review, then you don't leave them with this tom or something about, I've got something new, I've acquired something new. That adding on a little bit makes it exciting, makes it that there's something to look forward to each day, not just the review, but something new to learn. Rabba Baravuna, lo time mumsa, da maitili noka bei midrusha. And similarly, Rabba Baravuna, following in this path, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi had set out, also would not eat breakfast or have anything in the morning until he brought the youngsters to the Beit Midrash. So you see this, again, this importance of the connection between a grandparent and the grandchild, the Limud Torah. And again, not always about the Limud Torah itself, but a lot about the experiential and being involved in the fact that they get to school and that they go to learn. The fact that it was so important to his grandfather to take him to school that he was willing to go out without his head properly covered shows him, or shows the grandchild, the importance of what he's doing, and also is one of those indelible memories that you have that you'll never forget, your grandfather going out like that, taking you to school. Amar Rav Zafra, Mishum Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya. Mai dichtiv, what is meant in the Pasuk? Vishinantam livanecha. So what does that mean, vishinantam? I'll tikri vishinantam. Ela vishilashtem. Don't read it as vishinantam. Ela vishilashtem. Seems strange, because the word shinun means to review or to go over. Right? The shanot, that means to review. The Gemara uses it sometimes to do a second time. And here, the Gemara is saying, no, it means three times. And vishilashtem, split it up into thirds, rather than vishinantam, if you took it in that same way, would mean to split it in half. So Rashi says over here, the reason is because you could have, the word is written in a superfluous manner. So that the fact is it doesn't say vishanitem, which would be the equivalent of shinun, or to review, but rather uses vishinantem, it adds in an additional nun there, to add on a third leg. And that third leg is vishilashtem, shiashli shem, that you make them into three. And that's what the Gemara says over here, the interpretation is, yilolam yishalesh adam shnotav, person should split his life into thirds. Shlish b'mikra, one third in mikra over here, I think mikra has the broader definition, not like the narrow definition that Rava gave before of Torah, but mikra here would be Tanakh. Shlish b'mishnah, one third in Mishnah, shlish b'talmud, and a third learning Gemara. Where it says, b'yodea kamachayit. How does a person know how long he's going to live in order to split his life into thirds? You only can split your life in thirds if you know what your destination is. So lo, tzricha liyomei. Has to do with the days. The way Rashi interprets it is, yemei hashavua, that you divide your week up into thirds. The Balei HaTosafot are not comfortable with that. They say, v'lo ni'ira. Says the same problem that you have with the Gemara saying you split it up in by your years, then you have the same problem with Yemei HaShavua. You don't know how long you're going to last through the week, so how do you split your week up into thirds? So rather, the Balei HaTosafot learn it as one third of your day. Each day you should divide into thirds. Now, Mebechilat Kvodo Shalatosafot, then one day you have the same problem. Person's going to pass away in the middle of the day. So what are you going to say? Then the answer for the Balei HaTosafot is that it's too small a quantity of time to worry about death. Person doesn't get up in the morning thinking they're going to pass away that day. And so therefore, to split up the day into thirds is a reasonable amount of time. But the same way you could answer that way for the Balei HaTosafot, they could have answered for Rashi, which is a Shavua, a week, is again a reasonable amount of time where if a person plans in a week, he doesn't expect to pass away. Once you get into greater quantities of time, then the risk rises, and then there are issues about how to divide it up properly because of the risk that you don't make it. But in smaller quantities of time, like a day or a week, it seems reasonable that you could split it up, and that would be the answer for Rashi, which is Rashi says that a week is a reasonable amount of time to work with, and you can split it up in that way. Now, there is a secondary problem here, which is somewhat addressed by the Tosafot and some of the other Rishonim, which is that there's a quantitative problem, that you're dividing up into thirds material that is not of equal size. The Mikra is smaller than the Mishnah is smaller than the Talmud. So if you're dedicating one third of your time to each of these items, then you're going to give an uneven amount of time, meaning extraordinary amount of time to Mikra, when there's not enough content to fill in that time, and for the Talmud, you'll be shortchanging it. So the way that Rambam formulates it is that, Lo'olam Yishalesh Adam Shnotav is in the beginning of his learning career. That in the beginning of his learning career, the Bikiyut, the knowledge, is the most important aspect, and therefore splitting to thirds is reasonable because it's an acquisition of knowledge. It is getting the basic tenets and the basic knowledge of Torah. And in that case, Lo'olam Yishalesh Adam Shnotav, that a person should split it into thirds. But once he attains a certain base level of knowledge, then he should dedicate all his time to Talmud. That's the way the Rambam learns her to Iyun. Once you've passed the point of Bikiyut, and you have the basic knowledge that you need, and you have the quantitative side of it, then qualitatively you should dedicate more time to Iyun, which is the qualitative learning. And that's the way the Rambam formulates or seemingly deals with this issue. Others suggest that you have to use broader definitions of Mikra and Mishnah over here. Mikra and Mishnah is not simply Tanakh. Mikra means the Tanakh, plus the Midrashim on it, plus the Midrashei Halakha, and along the lines of what the Gra does in his lifetime, and later on in his life, and he does speak about the fact that a person should dedicate all his time to Torah. Obviously the Gra didn't mean literally to Torah or to the Psukim, but rather that you should be able to see in the Pasuk, when you read it, all the drashot of the Mishnah, the Gemara, it should be a derivative of the Psukim that you read in the Torah, so that the Torah Shebaal Peh is tied to the Torah Shebichtav. And therefore, you could speak about reviewing Torah Shebichtav, but within reviewing Torah Shebichtav is captured also aspects of Torah Shebaalpeh, and that way you would even out the thirds here, even though the content itself is not necessarily equal. So, nearly the phrase, b'chol yom v'yom atzmoi ashalish, alkein tikein b'seder Rav Amram Gaon. So, in the Sidur of Rav Amram Gaon, it says, k'mo sh'anu nagim b'chol yom, k'omdem p'suket ezimra. That's our practice before p'suket ezimra every day, to learn these three items. Lomar mikra mishnah gemara. And that is brought down in two different forms. In the Shulchan Aruch, he brings it down. Shabur also discusses it. But that we say mikra mishnah and gemara each morning in the korbanot. So one way to formulate that is that we have mikra, which is the korban tamid that we read about. Mishnah is ezu mikoman, which is a mishnah. And Rabbi Yishmael Omer is a braita from Torat Kohanim, and that is gemara. So there you have mikra, mishnah, and gemara that is laid out every morning. On the other hand, there are others who suggest that that comes out of our Birkat HaTorah. When we make the Birkat HaTorah, we have Mikra, which is the Psukim that we call Yivarech Hashem Yishmerecha Birkat Kohanim. Then we quote a Mishnah from Peah about Eilu Dvarim Shein Lehem Shiur. And then we quote a Braita, which is Eilu Dvarim Sheadam Ochel Perotem Olam Hazeh Ve'akirin Kayim Olam Haba. And they see that as being the Mikra, Mishnah, and the Gemara. So we have twice we do that sequence. Once associated with the Birkat HaTorah, once is our introduction to the Psukei HaZimra, but we have this concept of splitting up into the thirds, at least in the beginning of davening, having limud that is associated with each of these aspects. The famous Rabbeinu Tam is brought over here for the justification of why we don't do this. How come we don't follow this practice? Rabbeinu Tam perush anu sumchim ahad aminim b'Sanhedrin. That we rely on what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin with regards to Talmud Bavli. Why is it called Bavli? Bavel, Blula, B'mikra, Mishnah, Gemara. The Talmud Bavli has everything in it. It's Blula, B'kol, it's mixed up. It has Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara all in one. The Gemara is Bavel, Balul, Mikulam. And based on this, there's so much on the fact that if you learn Talmud Bavli, you're Mekayim this tzivoy of splitting your day into thirds and learning all Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. So that is the justification for the yeshivot, to only teach Gemara, and not to teach Tanakh, and not to teach Mishnah, but simply Gemara, because through Gemara you touch on all of these aspects. And again, this Rabbeinu Tam becomes very normative in many places, that this is the way that we accomplish this. Now the Gemara continues, Lefikach, Nikru Rishonim Sofrim. Now, Lefikach would seem to connect it to the previous Gemara. Although the way the Rashi reads it, it does not seem that he is connecting it to the previous Gemara. It's only a tangential, maybe precarious connection to the previous Gemara, and that this is really leading into a new sugya going forward, which is the Fikach Nikru Rishonim Sofrim. That's why the Rishonim were called Sofrim, because Sofrim Kol Ha'otiyot Shebetorah, because they used to count all the letters of the Torah. And the Rashi says, what is it Nikru Rishonim Sofrim? Kirichtiv, U'mishpechot Sofrim Yoshvei Yaivetz. So that's the Pasuk in Divrei Yamim, very early on in Divrei Yamim, which would attribute it to time of Yoshua, the Shoftim, somewhere around there, that they were called the Mishpachot Sofrim, Yeshvei Yavetz, that there were these people that were known as Sofrim, and here the Gemara is explaining why they're known as Sofrim. So we today associate Sofer with someone who writes a Torah, with writing of Stam, but here they're associating Sofrim with someone who counts. Counts means that he counts the letters of the Torah. That's the way Rashi interprets it. Tosafot, on the other hand, brings from the Yushalmi, that they made the whole Torah into numbers, the Mishnayot, that coalesce halachot and bring them together and say to you, there are 39 malachot on Shabbat. There are 4 avot nizikin. So they're taking the Torah and then trying to bring a categorization or summarization of what you find in the Torah into a topical way rather than simply by the psukim. And that's what it means, sofrim. Obviously, those Sofrim, according to the Balei HaTosafot, are later, probably later Sofrim, again, associated with the Mishnah, or the earlier Mishnayot, but also flows from what we said before, that the Sofrim here are a part of this transition from Mikra to Mishnah, which is that a person who's learning Mikra also has an association with Mishnah, an association with Talmud, because these Sofrim took that which is in the Torah and then compiled it into the Mishnah. So therefore, that could be an expansive view, again, of what Mikra is. That Mikra is not just learning the Chumash, but it's also associating that Mikra with what we know in the Mishnah, counting the 39 melachot. How do I get the 39 melachot? The Gemara in Shabbat brings numerous sources for that. One of those sources is the fact that the word melacha appears 39 times. So part of Mikra would be to enumerate those 39 times that melacha said. Or the juxtaposition to the Mishkan. All of those are limudim that derive from Mikra itself. And if you look at it in a more expansive view, that might be what is being explained here is what does it mean by Mikra? Right, so now they used to count all the letters of the Torah, Shomrim. Vav de Gachon, Chetzian Shalotiot Shal Sefer Torah. The Vav in the word Gachon, which we read in Parshat Shmini, about the kosher and non-kosher animals, and those animals that are Tmeim. So Kol Aleichal Gachon, that Vav of Gachon is the middle letter of the Torah. Dorosh, Dorash, Moshe is also in Parshat Shmini, with the burning of the Chatat after the death of the children Nadav and Aviu of Aaron. And there they burn the Chatat, and Moshe goes and queries them about why they burnt the Chatat. There's this Dorosh Dorash, Chetzian Shel Tevot. That's the midway point in the Torah for words. Vehit Galeach Shel Psukim. And Vehit Galeach in the Parsha of Tazria about the Mitzorah. That Vehit Galeach is the middle Pasuk of the Torah. Yirkasemenu Chazir Miyar, that he will chew it up like the way that the pig does in the forest. Ayin diyar chetzian shel teilim. The ayin in yar is the halfway point for teilim. Vahurachum yichaper avon is the chetzio b'psukim, is the halfway point in psukim. So here you have these sofrim who are telling you the layout of these, the Torah and teilim, and they're giving you demarcations of halfway points within them. Now that has significance not just in the fact that, oh, that's interesting, that's the halfway point, but also as part of the Mesorah, that if that is the halfway point, then you have to ensure that that which is before is half, that which is after is half. So you have a question about a word, or you have a question about letters, so on and so forth, you can determine the answer to that question based on the fact that they have to be the midway points. And therefore it'll tell you how many have to be before and how many have to be afterwards. So by Rav Yosef, the only problem is, Rav Yosef asks, Vav de Gachon, mehai gisa, mehai gisa. Is the Vav de Gachon from this side or that side? Amrulei, so they say to Rav Yosef, there's a simple answer to your question. Neite Sefer Torah ve'emninu. Well, just bring a Sefer Torah and we'll count the letters and then you'll know. Maybe that there's always an answer to the question. Maybe tedious, but there is an answer to the question. That's exactly what they did. They went ahead and they brought a Sefer Torah and they counted them. Now we have a problem, which is that we don't have an answer. All they say is they tell the story, but they forget to mention what was the conclusion from their count. Amar lahem, inu biki b'chaserot b'terot. The problem is that when they did that, they knew the dinim of chaser and yeter, which we know. We have mesorah about certain words which are written in Malay, certain words that are written in chaser, and sometimes letters that are there that we do not read, sometimes letters that aren't there that we do read. All of those mesorot, which would change the enumeration of letters, we are not bikiyim in them. We are not experts at that anymore. And therefore, I don't know, bikiyim, therefore counting them will do nothing for us because we can't be certain that we have the right count in terms of letters. And so for that reason, counting will not help us. This also has normative implications, which is that if you have a Sefer Torah that has a mistake in it, if the mistake is about a chaser and yeter, where it doesn't change necessarily the meaning, then in most cases we'll let the Sefer Torah go. The Chatchila, we wouldn't tell you to read from it, but if you're reading from it, we wouldn't make you put away the Sefer Torah just for that, because we're not bikiyim in chaser and yeter. So the fact that there's a mistake about a chaser and yeter may not be as problematic as a mistake of leaving out a letter or leaving out a word where we do have mesorot about these items. All right, so then he asks the question, by Rav Yosef it galeach, mehai gisa, mehai gisa. So he asks the same question about the psukim, which is this pasuk from the first half or the second half? Amalei psukei miyod etuvelim limnu ye. So Rabbi's student, the Rav Yosef, says to him, look, okay, fine, with letters, chaser and yeter, you're right, we're not experts, we can't count them up. But psukim, we know how the psukim break. And we know how the psukim break. Just count the number of psukim in the Torah, and we'll know which side Beit Galeach belongs to. He says, psukei nami lo bikin. We're also not experts at the count in psukim. Dichiata rav acha barada marava paskele the high crawl at lata psukei. Because we have a mesorah, or we have this, from the Bnei Eretz Yisrael, that in Shmot, Perek Yutet, when Hashem speaks to Moshe, by Mamad Har Sinai, where we have a single pasuk there, the Bnei Eretz Yisrael actually break that up into three psukim. So here, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Enoch Anochi Ba Lecha Be'av Ve'anan, It's a very long pasuk. Pasuk that Bnei Yisrael split into three different parts. They subdivided the pasuk. So now we have a problem also about the count of the psukim, which is that if they're splitting into three psukim and we have it as one pasuk, we're also not certain about the count of the psukim. So again, here, Rabbi Yosef asks about the breakdown of psukim and the breakdown of letters as to whether the one in the middle, is it belong to which side does it belong to? Again, by the words, he does not ask that question. Either for one of two reasons. Either because there they knew for certain that there was an even number of words, or because there it gives you two words. It says, darosh, darash. So when you have two words, you can say the one first word they gave is before the first half, and the darash is the second half. The other case, by gachon and by the pasuk, they only give you one pasuk and one letter. By doing so, it's uncertain as to which side that letter belongs to, or again, the other possibility is that it's an odd number, and that is the middle letter. And that's what Rav Yosef is uncertain about, and that's why he asks about the psukim and about the letters, but he doesn't ask about the words necessarily. This also, this fact that the Bnei Eretz Yisrael used to split the Torah, or split this pasuk into three psukim, might be a hint as to that practice of Bnei Eretz Yisrael, that they had a triannual completion of the Torah. Unlike the Bnei Babel who finished the Torah every year, the Bnei Eretz Yisrael used to finish the Torah every 3 years. And the truth is now there's been a lot of mechkar, academic writing on this matter, and it's shown that the cycle was actually not really 3 years, but really around 3.5 years. And they have evidence of that from letters and from writings from Bnei Eretz Yisrael as to the structure of how they read the Torah. Now again, in that structure, there were different sides. There's not one size fits all. It was not exact. And it seems that it even changed between communities how actually exactly they did that. I heard more recently by a number of teachers speaking on this matter that this actually makes it that in Eretz Yisrael, if you did 2 cycles of 3.5 years, that means that they completed the Torah twice every 7 years. And the cycle was actually set up to end on Simchat Torah. Simchat Torah, at least for Bnei Babel, seems to be an invention of the Galut, which is that they finished the Torah every year, but they also had a second day of Yom Tov, Shmini Atzeret, which in Eretz Yisrael is the day that we spend with Hashem. Now, if it's a unique day where you spend the day with Hashem, but there's no particular mitzvah associated with the day of Shmini Atzeret, then how could you have 2 days of Shmini Atzeret? Because Shmini Atzeret is supposed to be this unique day where we spend one extra day with God and you make it into 2 days. It takes away the uniqueness of the day. Similar to might be true about Yom Kippurim. Aside from the fact of fasting 2 days, how can you have 2 days of Yom Kippur when Yom Kippur is such a unique day? And so the same thing by Shmini Atzeret. So seemingly, Simchat Torah was a way for the Bnei Galut to deal with that, which is that they created, as part of that second day of Shmini Atzeret, they created an association with the Siyum HaTorah. And then there were all the drashot. They connect Shmini Atzeret with Siyum HaTorah and the uniqueness of Bnei Yisrael and our relationship with Hashem and the Torah being involved in that relationship. And they came up with Simchat Torah. And then it seemingly was re-imported into Eretz Yisrael. That today that in Eretz Yisrael we celebrate Simchat Torah seems to be an influence of the Galut back on Eretz Yisrael. But according to this explanation, it was true that even in Eretz Yisrael, Simchat Torah was celebrated. Not like in Bnei Babel every year, but every 7 years, and it coincided with Hakel, the requirements of the Torah on the 8th year, I mean the year after the Shemitah, which is every 7 years they would gather together in Yerushalayim, and there would be a public reading of the Torah, Sefer Dvarim, or the Melech, but what they are suggesting now is that this was a Siyum HaTorah, that it actually came out or worked out that the Siyum HaTorah would fall out on the Hakel of the 8th year of this cycle, and that there was actually a Simchat Torah that was in Eretz Yisrael. Much more infrequent, but it happened. It happened twice every 7 years. And then the breakdown of 3.5, 3.5 was not exact. And again, that has to do with that they used to set a time or a point at which all the communities would meet. They had communities that had different ways of dividing up the parshiot and different ways of dividing up the year. Part of that had to do with leap years. Part of it had to do with the way the holidays fall out. So there'd be all sorts of enumerations as to how many parshiot you would need to do this, based on the different years. So it wasn't exactly 3.5 and then 3.5, but it worked out over 7 years that you would finish it twice. You couldn't create a cycle that was 3.5 and 3.5, because over 7 years you could have different lengths of a year. Now the Bnei Babel dealt with that by having double parshiot and then splitting them up when you had a leap year. But when you're going over a longer cycle, that's a little harder to work with because you're not uncertain about a certain amount of the leap years. And so there were these self-adjustment cycles within the communities that they read this way, and then they all agreed to catch up, or there were points where they caught up. And that was the Siyum HaTorah. But because of that, you would then have this split up into three. This pasuk would be a hint at this triannual, or this cycling of Bnei Eretz Yisrael, where they had a much longer cycling of the Torah, rather than just a single cycling of Torah, like the Bnei Babel. Alright, Tan Rabbanan. Chameshet Alafim Ushmona Meot Ushmonim Ushmona Psukim Havu Psukei Sefer Torah. There are 5,888 Psukim in the Torah. The difficulty with that is that our count, or our Torahs, have about 5,845 Psukim, and not 5,888 Psukim. Yeter Alav Tehilim. Tehilim itself has 8 more Shmona Psukim. That Tehilim has 8 more Psukim in the Torah, which would imply that it has 5,896 Psukim. Chaser Mimenu Divrei Hayamim Shmona Psukim. And Divrei Hayamim is missing from that number 8. Now Divrei Hayamim would be Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Bet, because the split into Aleph and Bet, or the split over that, had to do either with the printing press or a anti-Semitic priest in England named Langton, who split it up, who was the one who devised the chapters and verses in the Torah. But that's not a Torah or Mesorah type of split, and therefore Divrei Hayamim would include Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Bet. Tosfot over here quotes from the Tosfot Ishanim, and he says, Teima, dal korchach b'chumash yesh yoter, filim yu psukei teileim migimol teivot bilvad. Even if you were to subdivide the psukim and teileim into three words, eino kolkach kemosh yesh b'chumash, still wouldn't reach the level of a chumash. And the way the Marsha deals with this, the question of the Tosfot Yishanim, is to say that just like we aren't bekiyim in the fact that one pasuk might be like three psukim, same might be true in reverse. Sometimes three or four psukim that we think are different psukim really are one big pasuk. And therefore, maybe we have the wrong count in the Torah as well. Who says we just have a wrong count within Tehillim? We might have a wrong count within the Torah. And the combination of those mistakes, both in the Torah and Tehillim, together could bring the levels and the numbers more on parity. The point being made by the Tosfot Yishanim now is that Tehillim doesn't have anywhere near this number of psukim. It's about a third of this number. And he says even if you took longer psukim, and you took the minimum amount of words in a pasuk to be three, you still wouldn't get to that number. And that's not true, because if you did split the psukim in the Torah and the Tehillim up, which are on an average of about 6 words, you actually would get to a number that's much higher. So the Pnei Yoshua criticizes the Marsha's claim against the Tosfot Yishanim. He says clearly that was not their intent. Their intent was just to say that some of the psukim in the Tehillim, if you took them and you could topically split them and have a minimum of 3 words, you still wouldn't get there, which is that there are certain psukim in Tehillim which topically split in the middle of the pasuk, and you still wouldn't be able to get there. And that's what the difficulty is. Pnei Yoshua also notes the fact that Tehillim has words or a number of words which we don't know. We saw that at the end of the Gemara Psachim and Arvei Psachim. The Gemara there is trying to figure out Haluluka, which perek it belongs to. Does it belong to the previous perek or the next perek? Is Haluluka one word, Haluluka, or is it Haluluka, two words? And all of these things impact on what we said before. What is the middle of Tehillim, as well as to the number of Sukkim that you would have in Tehillim? And that uncertainty could lead to numbers that are here. But it's clear that they are acknowledging the problem, which is that Sukkim and Tehillim and Divrei Hayamim are nowhere near the number of Sukkim in the Torah. Whereas, if you can see here, the Groz Aleph here leaves a Chaser, Daniel, Vid Divrei Hayamim. So he adds in additional Sfarim, and whether he means that all of Ketuvim, or somehow he's expanding the number of Sfarim here, in order to solve this problem, that Divrei Hayamim clearly doesn't have the requisite number of Sukkim to get to the level of the Torah. So the Groz says that there were more named Sfarim over here to get to that level. If that's the case, you could ask about the Tehillim the same question. What is the Gemara exactly after? Now, in terms of the Torah being 5,888 Psukim, the truth is that, again, we saw before that 5,845 is the number of Psukim that we have as our Mesorah in the Torah. And that could be solved by some of these problems like we mentioned before. There's certain psukim that you split into three in the Bnei Eretz Yisrael. There's also the fact that Pascha Be'emsa Pasuk, when you have a perek that breaks up in the middle of a pasuk, does that count as two psukim? Does that count as one pasuk? So there are certain sfeikot in the Torah that could get you between 5,845 and the 5,888, and that maybe could be reconciled. Tehillim, again, is much harder because Tehillim has 2,527 psukim, which is nowhere near this number of 5,888. Again, unless you do some fancy footwork or you start to explain that each pasuk, if you split it at the etnachta, or if you split the psukim along topical lines, maybe you can come up with a way to divide it along the lines where you'll get closer to this number, but it's not obvious, or it's not a natural outcome from this.
But then Yeshua does suggest another alternative, which is the plus 8 and minus 8 is only referencing the tens and the units part of the number, and not the totality of the number. Still doesn't work out perfectly, but he's trying to figure out a way to make the Gemara make sense without taking the total number of 5,888.
The other thing to discuss over here is the letters of the Torah, which is that here we say that the Gachon, the Vav Gachon, is the middle of the Torah. The question is, how many letters are there in the Torah? So there was a Mesorah that there were 600,000 letters in the Torah connected the number of Jews that were in the Midbar. And the way Pnei Yeshua expresses it, that was a notrikun, Israel. Israel, notrikun means as a Roshe Tevot, Yesh Shishim Ribo Otiot La Torah. That you can read Israel that way, that there's 600,000 letters in the Torah. The only problem with that is, if you actually look at it, there are not 600,000 letters in the Torah, but rather 310,000, roughly, letters in the Torah, not 600,000. Again, here, people are trying to deal with, what does that mean? Why is there 600,000? So one of the ways to solve the problem that the Pnei Yeshua notes is that it's talking about the Torah and the Targum. Because the Targum was given with the Torah, according to the Gemara and Megillah, and that the translation of the Torah in the Targum also should be included in the enumeration. That's how you get there. Or you could, the possibility of counting the number in a different manner, that's due with the Kri and the Ktiv of the Torah. But there are two Mesorot with regards to the West Sefer Torah. There's a Mesorah about how to write the Torah, there's a Mesorah about how to read the Torah. So we really only focus on it on particular words, where the Kri and the Ktiv are essentially different, where the word is pronounced differently than the way that it's, the letters are put into the Torah. We've seen a number of those already. We just saw that on yesterday's daf, Tifteh and Tipadeh. Those differences we only note then. But he says it's true of all the words of the Torah, that there's a Kri and a Ktiv, because many times we have words that have silent letters in them, like the Aleph and the Ayin. And so therefore he believes that there's a Mesorah both for Kri and Ktiv. He says based on that, you would get roughly double the number of 310,000 letters. You would get up to 600,000 if you looked at the Kri and the Ktiv Mesorah. And that's how he says you get to this 600,000 number, rather than the actual number of 310,000 letters that are associated with the Torah. All right, so now the Gemara continues and says, Tarabanan, Vishinantam, Shei Divrei Torah Michudadim Bificha. Then when it says Vishinantam, again, the Lashon of Vishinantam has numerous meanings. We just saw before Vishinantam from the word Vishanitam, to review or to go over again. And we saw that it was a strange spelling of it. Here the Gemara takes a different approach, which was with Shinun, which just means to be sharp, like a tooth is sharp. Vishinantam Shei Divrei Torah Michudadim Bificha, you should be sharp with them. Shemishalucha Adam Davar, Altin Gamgeim V'Tomarlo. If someone asks you something, don't stutter. Don't be hesitant in responding. Elamor Lo Miyad, you should respond immediately. Shenemar, Emor L'Chochma Achotiat. You have to say to knowledge and wisdom, you are like my sister. The way Rashi brings down two interpretations of what that means. One is that just like you are, know your sister, you're so familiar with your sister, that type of knowledge is the type of familiarity you should have with the Divrei Torah. Or the other thing is that something that is as obvious as being asur as your sister is asur b'arayot, so too all the halachot or all the things of the Torah should be so obvious or clear to you. Vomer, and it says, kashreim al etzbotecha, you should tie them to your fingers, like a ring on your fingers. Katvei maluach libecha, inscribe them on the board of your heart. I mean that you should be so integrally connected to Torah that it's as if you're wearing them on your hand or they are written on your heart. Omer, kechitzim biyad gibor kein b'nei ha'ne'urim. Just like the arrows are in the hands of the strong man of the warrior, kein b'nei ha'ne'urim. So too, the tamidav shel adam, that's what Rashi says, the students of an individual who are called banim, they should be as sharp as those arrows that are shot by the gibor. Now this has actually implications because the Gemara on yesterday's daf, when asking for a source, the fact that the obligation is to teach one's son and not one's daughter, They do not bring the pasuk of Vishinantam Levanecha. Instead, they bring the pasuk of the Maritam Otam et Bnechem. And the question is, why didn't they bring Vishinantam Levanecha? So some bring down in that vein that the answer to that is that Vishinantam Levanecha is not just referring to children, but also referring to students. And therefore, if you have that more expansive view, you can't make a limud there of Vishinantam Levanecha to teach Levanecha below Benotecha, because over there, Benecha is not literally your children, but your figurative children, which includes your students. And that's why the Gemara brought the Gemara Tem Otam et Bneichem, where there it's the literal children rather than Mishinantam Levanecha. And you see Rashi interpreting that in this way here, that the Bnei Neurim is connecting back to what the Gemara just said about Mishinantam Levanecha. Vomer, Chitzei Gibor Shinunim. That the arrows of the Gibor are Shinunim. So again, Shinunim over here would be sharp or lethal, but it also has Shinunim like Mishinantam Levanecha. And therefore, there's this correlation between the arrows of the Gibor and the Limud Torah, and that, v'mer, chitzecha shinunim amim tachtecha yiplu, with your sharp arrows, other nations will be subjugated under you. V'mer, pasukens, as Rashi says, asher milei et ashpoto mehem. Ashrei gever she milei et ashpoto mehem. That it, lucky is the man who's filled up his quiver with the arrows. So too, here the Gemara figuratively is saying it about Torah. Lo yivoshu ki dabru et oivim b'shar. He will not shrivel up. He will not be embarrassed when the enemies speak in the shar. As you see here from the Gemara, what they're sensing is, what is dabru et oivim? What does that have to do with speaking to enemies when you're dealing with arrows and giborim? Because this pasuk that we're quoting here is a pasuk immediately after the one that we quoted before from Tehillim Kuf Chav Zayin. There we quoted pasuk Dalit, that ki chitzecha b'yad giborim kein b'nei aneurim. And then it continues afterwards, ashrei agever shemilei tashpato mehem, lo yivosh ki dabru et oivim bashar. So what is this idea of collecting of arrows and speaking to the oivim? It seems to be that there is some sort of connection or correlation with limud Torah, or speaking, and that's what the Gemara is taking this, not literally, but figuratively, the idea of filling up your quiver with arrows, and also being sharp like the arrows, that you can have the impact with your Torah, which is immediately answered when there is a question that is asked, rather than have to go and seek out the answer or look for the answer later on. My etoyvim b'shtar, why does it call them enemies in the gateways? Even a father and a son, or a Rebbe and his Talmid that are delving into Torah, are toiling in Torah, b'shar echad, under one gate. They become like enemies, that each one of them takes a position, they're arguing their positions. They don't leave there until they are in love, meaning in the sense that they reconcile. Because this is a milchama shel Torah, milchamta shel Torah, which is after the truth. And therefore, when the truth, or from their arguments, comes out the truth, then they're nasim ovim shnemar et vahev basufa. So there it says, there was written, b'sefer milchamot Hashem. Sefer milchamot Hashem. What's the sefer of the milchamot Hashem? That's the Torah. And the milchamot Hashem are milchamot, or arguments, l'shem shamayim. People are arguing in Torah. Et vahev basufa means, al tikra b'sufa la b'sufa. And the word vahev they're doing is ahev. Then in the end, they will be loving. They will reconcile between them because all that they're learning and their arguments are all the same shamayim. And so that will be the end game for this type of kol. Acholkot ishi l'shem shamayim ends up in a proper pace of the two parties reconciling and loving each other. Even though during the discussion or during the debate, that they take sides and they argue and they push back and forth and they become like enemies, the result is a unified force because of the fact that they, by that way, melabein and smelt the Torah to get to the pure emet between the two of them. Tanu Banan, v'samtem et ra'il alavavchem. What is v'samtem? What does it mean, sima? What do you mean you place it? And it says, samtam, that it is like a potion or a mixture that is whole, which means Nimshala Torah Kisam Chaim. The Torah is like the potion of life. Mashal Adam Shikat Bino Makak Dola. It's like a mashal that a person who, it says here that he hit his child, Makak Dola, gave him a big wound, which is true if this child has a wound, Viniach Lo Ritial Makato. And then he put a plaster on that wound in order to protect it and take care of it. Ramallah Bini, Kozman Sharitiya Zua Makatcha, as long as you keep this bandage on your wound, Achol Mashanatcha, eat what you may please, Shata Mashanatcha, drink what you please, Rachotzbo Ben Bechaimim Ben Mitzonein, you can take baths, showers, you can go in the hot, the cold water. Benata Michere, you don't have to worry about it. It's covered, it's well protected, and it's sealed. Vimata Mavira, but if you take off the plaster, if you take off this wound care, then Harehi Malen Numi, then it'll grow fungus, but in a broader sense, it'll become infected because it's not covered, it's not taken care of. Kacha Kodesh Baruch Hu Malayam Yisrael, Banai, Barati Yetzara. I created the evil inclination, Ubarati Lo Torah Tavlin. But I did give the spice that's able to solve the problem or the cure for the Yetzara, which is the Torah. Im atem oskim b'Torah, if you toil in Torah, en atem nimsarim b'yado, you will not be given over to the hands of the Yetzara. Shenemar. So here's the psukim that are by Kayin when Hashem says to him, Hello, im teitev se'et. If you so choose to do or go in the way of good, meaning learn Torah, se'et. You will be ascendant. You will be able to rule over the Yetzara. V'im ein atem oskim b'Torah, but if you do not toil in Torah, atem nimsarim b'yado, then you will be handed into the hands of the Yetzara. Shenemar. The petach hatat roveitz, it sits crouched, awaiting at the doorway for that moment when the person is not toiling in Torah. V'lo'od el shechol maso matano b'cha, that the Yetzirah spends his whole day trying to figure out how to get you. Shneamar ve'lachat shukato, his desire is towards you. I mean, that's his whole desire, his whole life's goal was to cause you to trip up and to sin. And so, if you want to deal with him, b'im ata rotzeh, ata moshobo. But if you decide and you're willing, you can rule over him, you can mitigate his actions, shenemar batatim shobo, because you can rule over him. So that's the idea that Torah is talim or sam chayim. The Gemara in Erevin is even more explicit about this, that it says that they're all different medicines for different pains and diseases, but it says that Torah is the greatest cure for all things, because all medicines and all cures have side effects. The Torah has no side effect, only has good with it. Therefore, the Gemara in Erevin says, Chash perosho, yasok b'Torah. Chash b'grono, yasok b'Torah. He's got a headache, should learn Torah. He's got a sore throat, learn Torah. Chash b'me'ayim, he's got a stomachache, yasok b'Torah. Literally taking this as being a sam chayim, the potion of life, or a medicinal solution to everything. Terminan, kashe yitzara, shefil yotzro koro ra. The Yetzirah is so evil or so difficult that even a Kodesh Baruch Hu called him Ra, Shneemar. Ki Yetzir Lev Adam Ra, Minu Rav. God says that the heart of man is evil from his young age. This is after the Mabul, when Hashem promises not to destroy the world again, he acknowledges the Yetzirah being something very difficult to contend with. Am Rav Yitzchak, Yetzro Shel Adam Mitchadei Shela B'chol Yom. That a person's desires or Yetzir Hara is renewed each day. Shneemar, rak ra, kol hayom. He's only thinking evil all day. Now what does it mean, kol hayom? It could just say rak ra. What does it mean, kol hayom? Kol hayom means all day. Every day and all days. Every day he's after you and he has renewed strength to go after you each day. Rabbi Shimon Levi, or Rabbi Shimon Lakish, is the other girsa. Yitzro shel adam mitgarer alav b'chol yom umvakesh hamito. The Yetzirah of a person gets stronger each day and wants to kill him. Shneamar. Sofer Rasha Letzadik. The evil one looks towards the Tzadik, the righteous one. Umevakesh la'amito. And he wants to kill him. V'yomalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ozro. En Yecholo. And without the help of Hashem, he would not be able to overcome it. Shneamar. Elokim Lo'yozvenu Biyado. That's the other half of the Pasuk, which is, even though the Rasha wants to kill the Tzadik, God will not let him be handed over to the evil one. Won't leave him in the hands of that evil one. Tana b'nei Rabbi Shmuel, b'nei, im paga b'cha menuval zeh, if this disgusting one, this Yetzirah, bumps into you, mashcheu l'beit midrash, drag him to the beit midrash, im even hu nimoach. If he's a stone, he'll be melted, v'im barzelu mit potzeitz. And if he's metal, it will shatter, it'll split, it'll explode. Shneemar, halo ko divari ke'esh nu'um Hashem. Isn't my word, Hashem says, like fire? Ukipatish yifotzeitz sela, like the hammer that splits the stone. Rashi has to then compensate for the fact that the pasuk doesn't exactly say what the Gemara says over here, which is the fact that If he is a rock, it'll melt. And if it is barzel, if it's metal, mitpotzeitz, it explodes or it goes away. In this pasuk, it seems the other way around. Batisha potzeitzel, it's like the rock splits from the hit of the hammer, and that the eish doesn't really seem associated with either of these two. But what Rashi suggests over here, just like eish is mifapeya barzel, just like fire causes metal to melt and to bubble, so too, the Eish of the Dvari, I mean, the Eish of Hashem, which is His word, the word of the Torah, that will affect the metal. Ukipati shifotzei tzela, just like the hammer splits the rock. V'im evenu ni moach, and how do I know if it's a rock, it melts? Shinemar hoi kol samei l'chudamayim. That all those that are thirsty should go to water. V'omer avanim shachakumayim. It says that the rocks are worn down by the water. So now the Gemara says, hoi kol samei l'mayim is referring to the mashal. It's a mashal of the Torah. Then anyone who's thirsty for Torah goes to Mayim, goes to Torah, which is Torah is nimshalak in Mayim. The Torah is compared to water. And in its comparison to water, we see that water can wear down rocks. And so too, the Torah can wear down a rock. So that's based on the girsa that we have and the way that Rashi interprets the pasuk, that pasuk of Kepatishi Fotzeitzela. Tosfot brings over here alternative girsaot, as well as an alternative explanation. The first alternative girsa is, v'yishkareskanim barzelhu mipapeya. If it's barzel, it bubbles up. V'imselhu mitpotzeitz. And if it's a rock, it splits. Now that would make sense then, because the pasuk says that my word is like fire. And then you talk about a hammer, so the fire affects the barzel of the hammer, and then the hammer hits the rock, and the rock splits. So that would be actually a better girsa, that the splitting would be associated with the rock, and the melting would be associated with the metal. Now Rashi does that by explaining the pasuk that way anyway, but even though, wait, we have our girsa just the opposite. And then he brings down the parish of the Rebbeinu Tam, which Tosafot brings many places in Shas, with regards to this pasuk of Patishi Fotzei Tzela. The Gemara brings this in other places to explain Shivim Panim, the Torah. That there's so many different ways to interpret the Torah, perspectives on Torah, abilities to be Doresh Ereb Sukim, and that's what it means, Patishi Fotzei Tzela. So Rashi learns over there in the same way, like just like when the hammer hits the rock, many sparks fly out, so too the Torah can be divided in many directions, or just like the hammer hits the rock and the rock splinters into many pieces, that is like the Torah that can be made into many parts or has different perspectives to it. That's the way Rashi always explains it, and similarly over here he explains it this way. The Rebbeinu Tam sees that the Mashal and Nimshal don't work that way, especially in other places, and therefore he says it's the other way around. Kifatish yifotzeitz sela. The question of what is the subject and what is the object in the pasuk is not clear. The way that we're reading it is that the subject is the hammer, and that it's yifotzeitz, the object is the sela, and the sela is broken by the hammer. Rebbeinu Tam reads it just the opposite. He says, kifatish, like the hammer, yifotzeitz sela. The rock splits the hammer. A metallic hammer can be smashed by the rock. And he brings examples of that, of very strong things like diamonds that split the metal. And then the Gemara here is more understandable, and it also in those other places the Mashal and the Imshal work out better. But because of that, he explains that the Fatish Futzeitzela, that's not a proof that the rock splinters, because here the rock's not splintering, the hammer is splintering. And that's what it means, that if the hammer breaks up or metal breaks because of the Divrei Torah, because that's what it says, Fatish Futzeitzela, that the hardened rock can smash the hammer. That's what happens. The hammer is smashed by the rock which is the Torah, can smash the hammer. And that's what the Gemara was looking for. That the Gemara was bringing a proof to the fact that metal is mitpotzeitz. And then it brings the proof about the rock melting from the subsequent pasuk, and that fits better into Lashon HaGemara, the way the Rebbeinu Tam explains it. Alright, now, Lasio Isha said in the Mishnah that one of the obligations of the father towards the son is that he has to marry him off. He has to get him a wife. Minolon, how do we know this is true? Dichtiv, because the pasuk says, Khunashim ve'olidu banim banot. You should take a wife and give birth to sons and daughters. Ukhulev nechem nashim. And then you should take wives for your sons. Ve'et benotechem snulet anashim. And then your daughters you should give to men. So here's the proof. The proof is that khu levnechem nashim. That you should take for your sons wives. So that's the obligation here of a father to provide a wife for his son or make sure that his son has a wife. But the Gemara then asks on the second half of the pasuk, which says that you should give your daughters to suitors. So Bishlamo bno biyado. When it comes to his son, he has control over the situation because the daughter or the woman is the one that's taken into the marriage. So he can work with his son to acquire, quote unquote, a wife. On the other hand, bito biyado he? Your daughter, you don't have that because you need a suitor. You need someone who's going to marry. You can't go and demand that, oh, here, you know, I have this great girl for you. Come over here. That's not the way it works. The man is the suitor. And therefore, how can you ensure that your daughter gets married? It's not in your control. Even though, in a more generic sense, the father has more control over the daughter because he has to acquiesce to the request in marriage and he has to negotiate to allow his daughter to get married. Nevertheless, in terms of suitors, the man is generally the suitor, and therefore, even if he wants his daughter to get married, he needs a man who's interested in marrying his daughter. Whereas the man who's the suitor, it's much easier for the father to intervene or help the son in finding a woman and in being a suitor towards an appropriate woman. So, achikamarlu, this is what's meant in the pasuk. Nitan la midei uvashaya v'nichsaya. Right, you should give her a trousseau. You should dress her up in fancy clothes. You should give her a dowry that will make her appealing. So that people will chase after her. You have to make your daughter appealing, and that's how you marry off your daughter. You're right, you can't. She's not the suitor, and she has to wait for someone to come and ask her hand in marriage. But you can make her much more appealing, or make her hand much more appealing in marriage and desirable. And that's what the requirement is over here. But the obligation with regards to the son is literally to ensure that he gets married, and to take for him a wife. Which we see many times in the Gemara, that the Amoraim would go over to other princes' house and they negotiate to get their son a wife in this other location. Lamdo umanut. You also have an obligation to teach him a profession. Minolan. How do you know that's true? Amr Chizkiya, the Amr Kral, the Pasuk says, Ve'ei chayim im isha asher hafta. The Pasuk Gemara says, see your wonderful life with the woman that you loved. Now the Gemara sees the word chayim referring to livelihood, meaning your ability to live. And then isha, the Gemara is going to take one of two ways. Either you take it literally, it means a wife, or isha sometimes is used to refer to divrei Torah. Like in Eshet Chayil, the Gemara has two interpretations of that. One is literal about the isha, or the other one is that it's a mashal, a Torah, and that the isha that is spoken about there is Torah. So it's over here. Im isha mamashi, if the pasuk is literal, and it means a wife, k'shem shechayav lasio isha, k'chayav lamdo umanut. Just like the father has an obligation to take for him a wife and have him married off, so too he has an obligation to ensure that he has chayim, that he has a way or a means by which to make a living. Im torahi, if you say that this is a mashal l'torah, and that isha is not literal, but isha means Torah, shem shechayav l'lamdo Torah, just like you're obligated to teach him Torah, kach chayav l'lamdo umanot, so too you have to give him a profession. There's an equal obligation on the parent, and this goes in both directions. That means that just like you have an obligation to ensure that they get a profession, you also have to make sure that they get learned Torah. And that means that they have equal standing, but also equal investment. That you can't just invest in the child and say you have to do well in this and do well in that and then go to college and then go to graduate school all for your profession, and at the same time not ensure that their learning of Torah is on par with their professional pursuits and the amount of investment they make in their profession. But the same thing the other way around, which is that if you're going to invest in their limud Torah, you also have to provide them a means by which they can make a living afterwards. And therefore you have to invest equally, meaning that in the Torah that they do, they also have to invest in an umanot so that they have a means by which to make a living afterwards. And so there is a certain amount of parity that is laid out by this pasuk between umanot and Torah, but again, that cuts both ways, which is that you can't have too much emphasis on either side. It has to be a balance between the two. And the Marsha notes that both interpretations are true, which is what type of life are you going to have with your wife if you don't have a skill or a trade or a means by which to support her. And so therefore, a chayim im isha is only valuable if you have chayim, if you have what to live by. And in the drush, it's also true. The tevi adrash im torahi, talad davar b'torah, d'gamim osek tamid b'torah. Even if he's all the time, or on a regular basis, osek b'torah, tzrich l'umanut. He needs a way or a means of making a parnasa. V'lo yismoch al anes. And you just rely on a miracle that all of a sudden his parnasa will show up. Like we say in the Mishnah Navot, that any Torah that doesn't have work or a means of support associated with it, sofa b'teila, in the end, it is worthless and will become batel. And even those that wanted to dedicate their lives to Torah, the Gemara in Brachot, when mentioning that, says that they made their Torah keva, that was the most important or the fixed part of their life, and melachtan arai, and their work was the temporary or the fill-in. So, yes, their primary pursuit and their primary investment was in their Torah, but still it was not to the exclusion or the preclusion of making a living, which was arai, that they did it on occasion here and there, even though it wasn't a permanent form of work or a regular form of work. Nevertheless, it was an ability to support themselves. The Meiri over here suggests, based on the Mishnah that we're going to see later on in the Masechta on Daf Pei Bet, that when here it's speaking about Umanut, Umanut not only includes what we'd call the skill or a trade, but also includes Divrei Torah. And that's what's said in the Mishnah there, Rabbi Nurai Omer, Miniach Ani Kol Umanut Shebalam, Ve'im Elamed Et Bini El Torah, that I would give up any other craft or any other skill in order to learn Torah. Implying that Rabbi Nai believes that Torah, or the learning of Torah, is on par or is an umanut of sort, and therefore it's a worthwhile investment and can count as an umanut that you teach the child. Some say that you also have to teach him to swim. My taima, chiyuteyu, because that's chayim, that's livelihood, that's keeping him alive. Now it's interesting, in their day, the way Rashi phrased it is because, and Rashi in the Mishnah said this, is because if a boat capsizes, how is he going to survive the boat accident? Now, that was the most common case of being in the water, was a boat. And a lot of times when you're on a boat, the boat's capsized or something went wrong with the boat in a storm, and you were left in the water. And if you can't swim, then that was the end for you. So the swimming was chiyute because the mode of transportation involved being on the water. And a lot of times, it was not uncommon that there were accidents on the water and you needed to swim. Today, that swimming also involves that, but a lot of times also has to do with the recreational side and people being in water and swimming for that reason, not simply for the reason of being out on boats. It said in the Mishnah that anybody who doesn't teach his son a trade is teaching him to be a thief, a marauder, mercenary of sorts. That's what we saw in the Gemara before, that it's not that he's teaching him to be a thief, but rather he's giving no alternative other to be a thief. So my binayu, what's the difference between Rabbi Yehuda and the Tana Kama? Iga binayu dagmre iska. If he teaches him how to work in business. So according to the Tana Kama, that's fine. You taught him a trade, you taught him an ability to make a living. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda demands you teach him an umanut, you teach him a skill or a trade that he can use. Business goes up and down. Business is only available if you have what to invest, if you have something to work with, or that the times are opportune. When a person has a skill or a trade, that can be used at any time, that's valuable at any time. That's true even today. The same differentiation is true, that if you give them a skill set, that skill set can always be used. If they're involved in business, those have their ups and downs, and you don't have necessarily something to sell. Right now, the Gemara moves on to the second half of the Mishnah. This is called mitzvot av ala ben, that all the mitzvot of the father on the child. Now, Gemara has the same question here as it had on the first half of the Mishnah, which is, just like the first half of the Mishnah was somewhat ambiguous, and the Gemara had to figure out what it meant, Gemara asks the same questions over here. Whereas, what does this mean? My kol mitzvot av ala ben, all the mitzvot of the father on the child. Ilei mo kol mitzvot ad mechayv av ala meved debrei. If you think it's all the mitzvot the father has to do towards his son, nashim chayavot, women are chayavot in that? Because the second half of the mission says that both men and women are equally chayavot in this issue. Vatanya, and we bring the bright that we brought to explain the first half of the Mishnah, which is, Rav chayav ibno, father is obligated toward his child to do the following things. The moldo, to give him a brit milah, liftoto, to do pinyon of ben, aviv in imolo. And the deal we have with that bright is that it's his father's obligation, not the mother's obligation. So Rabbi Yehuda, Chikamar, so Rabbi Yehuda again over here clarifies the language of the Mishnah, similar to what he did in the first half of the Mishnah. Kol mitzvot av hamutelot al haben. It's not the father's obligation towards the child, but mitzvot that involve parents, that is the obligation on the child. Lasot aviv, that's the obligation that the child has to do towards his father. Echad anashim ve'echad nashim. Chayavin. Here there's no differentiation between men and women. Everybody is obligated. The classic example is what the Gemara is about to bring down that I mentioned before. Tanina ha de Tanu Rabbanan. Now our Mishnah is reinforcing or corroborating what we saw in a Braita. Ish en li ala ish. I would only know a man. Isha minayin. I don't know what applies to a woman. Shomer tirou harikan shnayim. The fact that he uses a plurality in the end of the Pasuk, tirou, teaches you that we're talking about two subjects over here. Simkein matam lomar ish. Then why did the pasuk start off with ish? The Gemara is going to pasuk of ish imova aviv tiro. So it says a man must fear his parents. So the Gemara says, does that mean only a man and not a woman? The Gemara says no. It says tiro at the end. Tiro is in plural, and therefore the ish in the beginning of the pasuk means ish v'isha. Man and woman are both chayavin in Yirat Aviv V'Imo. And so you see here, there's this equal obligation when it comes to mitzvot vis-a-vis your parents. There's an equal obligation on the man and the woman. But if that's the case, why did the Torah write ish if it really meant ish v'isha? So the Gemara says, ish sipek biyado la'asot, isha in sipek biyada la'asot. That's because a man has the capacity to do the mitzvah, whereas a woman does not have that capacity, in pnei sherushut acherim aleha, because she's in some ways beholden to another party, which is her husband. And since her kavod, or yirat abal, takes precedence over that of her parents, so now she has the inability to, therefore, execute on the mitzvah. So that's why the Torah emphasizes ish, ish. It's a permanent obligation on the man, because he always has that obligation. The woman who, at some point in her life, will not be independent, there she can't fulfill this obligation. For a number of reasons, both sociological, which in their time, the standing of the woman, as well as those of notes over here that, even though technically the woman's maseya daim only to razmi the rabbanan, which means that if the oraita, she was obligated to use that towards her parents, that would trump. Nevertheless, he says it's just a practical problem, is that the woman's just not found near her parents. And so not only is there a problem of independence or financial capability to do it, there's also a locational issue, which is that the woman is normally found by the husband's family. That the woman used to go live by the husband's family. And therefore she wasn't even around to perform kibud avim. Now today, a lot of this has changed both in the standing of the woman as well as sociologically, which is that many times they end up living near the woman's parents and not the husband's parents, but as well as the fact that a woman is seen much more equal in the marriage, and therefore she might have, and probably has the capacity today to do, perform kibud avim, even though technically she really is beholden to her husband first, nevertheless, she has much more of a capacity or ability to perform kibud avim, and therefore it might be much more of an equal obligation today than what the Gemara is describing over here. Amrav Yidah Bav and Amrav Nitgasha Shneihem Shavim. But if she gets divorced, then both, meaning both the Ish and the Isha, are equally obligated, and that's when the woman is independent, she has a full-fledged obligation to perform mitzvot that relate to one's parents. It says one must honor their parents. And it says, that you should give honor to Hashem mehonecha from your wealth. Tosfot over here mentions that mehonecha, some interpret to mean mechoncha, which means ma'asher chanan mecha Hashem, that which Hashem has blessed you with or bestowed upon you. This parallel between the necessity to provide honor to one's parents and honor to Hashem, the fact that the Torah and Mishlei use a similar phraseology of kabeid, this demand for honor, the Gemara sees a parallel between them, and saying that kibud avim and kibud Hashem are of its same nature and of parallel importance, and therefore they said, based on this, chonecha teaches you that by Hashem it says that you only have to give honor to Hashem and use what Hashem has granted you to honor Hashem, but that means you have to have the means by which to do this. On the other hand, by kabeidet avicha v'etimecha, where it doesn't give that limitation, you have to go around and you have to knock on doors and get money and do whatever it is to give that honor to your parents, because the obligation is not limited me'onecha. I think, lulei divrei tosafot, you can read it the other way, which is the fact that the Torah parallels kabeidet avicha v'etimecha to kavod Hashem. And by kavod Hashem, there's this limitation of you can only give what you have. So too, by kibud avim, you can only give that which you have. That obligation can't stand beyond that you could read this almost in the opposite manner that the Baal Yad Tosafot do. But here the Gemara says, Hishva katuv kibud avim l'kvod ha-makom. The Torah creates a equation of equality between kibud avim and kibud Hashem. Ne'emar ish imo v'aviv tirao, there's an obligation to fear one's parents. Ne'emar et Hashem lokecha tira v'oto tavo, that you have to fear God and you have to serve Him. Hishva katuv mara av'aim l'marat ha-makom. Again here, there's this equation of equality between fearing one's parents and fearing God. I mean, the Torah makes the same demand about a parent as it makes with regards to God. But Nehemiah also says, Mikalel aviv imo motumat, one who curses his parents, chas v'shalom, is put to death. But Nehemiah, ish ish ki yagalel aluka v'nesach etom. That a person who, chas v'shalom, curses a kodesh baruch hu, he'll also have to carry that chait and he is punishable by death. Yishva katuv birkata av v'aim v'birkata makom. Lashon Saginorir, that bracha, giving a bracha, which means cursing one's parents and a Kodesh Baruch Hu v'chas v'shalom, are equated.
So you see this, the Gemara says, you see all sorts of halachot that apply by parents, and the same halachot apply by Hashem, to tell you that there's some sort of equation of equality between them. And what are you going to say about ba'aka'ah? What about hitting? Vadayi efshar. So over there, makeh aviv v'imo, even though there's a punishable by death for hitting one's parents, it's only relevant by parents, it's not relevant by God. So there it only mentioned the parents and not God. But by other mitzvot that relate to one's parents, there each time we see a parallel mitzvah with regards to the Kodesh Baruch Hu. V'chein b'din. And it makes sense that that should be the case. Shloshtam shutafim bo. Because the three of them are partners in his creation. Which is that, Tan Rabbanan, shlosha shutafim ein ba'adam. There are three partners in the creation of man, a Kodesh Baruch Hu, v'aviv v'imo. The mother and the father, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu. When a person provides honor towards his parents, it's as if I lived amongst them and they gave me honor. Because honoring the parents is the equivalent of honoring Hashem, because they are all partners in the creation of this person. So therefore, if a person treats his parents properly, it's as if he's saying, I treat all the partners equally, and all the partners deserve kavod. And so when you give kavod to parents, it's as if you're giving kavod to Hashem as well, or to the partnership as a whole. And the Marsha notes over here that this idea that when you do kibud aveim, there's equivalent of kavod HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is that because many of the items that we're going to see in tomorrow's daf, which are involved in kibud aveim and yirat aveim, are not necessarily applicable directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Feeding one's parents, providing for them, is something that is an obligation that wouldn't be necessarily applicable by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's what it says. Since we're all partners in this, when you do that kibud aveim and you perform that kavod to your parents, it's as if I consider it as if you did kavod for HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well, because of the nature of the partnership here, that kibud aveim is the equivalent of kibud to Shamayim and kibud to Hashem. Rashi notes over here that the Braita in Nida says what each contribution of each member is, which is ish mazria loven, since the man's contribution is the semen which is white, Isha Mazret Odem, and the woman whose contribution is red, her menstrual cycle that is the red, Shabo, the father gives him the white aspects, and that's like the bones, the sinews, the nails, and the brain, and the white of the eye, areas of the body that are white, and the woman gives the blood and the red parts of the body and the flesh, skin of the blood, the hair, and the black, the pupil of the eye, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu nofeach bo neshama. And then Hashem gives him the life force, which is Maria Ayin, the fact that he can see, Ushmiyat Ozna, he can hear him, Medaber, that he's a living being, that Hashem blows his Shema into him to give him the living being, and each one is a contributing member of the partnership to the development of the individual, both physically and spiritually. Tanya, Rabbi Omer, Galuvia, Dulifne, Misha, Marvei, Odaam, who's clear to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Sheben Mechavedet Imo Yoter Me'aviv, that a son or a child gives more honor to his mother than to his father, Mipnei, Shemishtaldoto Bidvarim. Because, as Rashi says, Mishtaldoto Mifateh, she seduces him with her words, with her cooking. She's always sweet and nice. That's the nature of the mother and the motherly instinct. And therefore, he's more apt to give kavod to his mother. The fikach, therefore, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the command, it says, Hikdim HaKadosh Baruch Hu kibud av lekibud aim. It says, Kavedet avicha. The father went first to show you that you have to give the equal kavod to your father and your mother. Even though more naturally a person gives kavod to his mother, the father's kavod still has to be on that same par. It's also, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was aware of the fact that a person, a child, fears his father much more than his mother, because the father, quote unquote, is the enforcer, is the stricter one, is the rules. Because he teaches him Torah. He teaches him boundaries. He gives him guidance and structure around him. Therefore it says, Ish imo v'aviv tirou. So imo goes before aviv, because there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the natural tendency of an individual is to fear his father more than his mother. And therefore he put the mother first to say that you have to have equal fear of your parents. And again, the Gemara will discuss what exactly is the requirements of kibud aveim and yirat aveim in the upcoming Gemaras. Okay, we're going to stop here. Five lines down on the top of Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph.